Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Occupy Wall Street media team members Mark Bray and Senya Berrigan, who talk about the police raid which dismantled their New York City encampment and the future of the Occupy movement nationwide. Professor of Economics Richard Wolff, who assesses the power of the Occupy Wall Street movement and why he believes the conflict seen in Europe's economic crisis could be a preview for the battles ahead here in the United States. And Palestinian academic, author, and activist Mazen Qumsian, who presents a short history of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance struggle. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the 16th anniversary of the hanging of Nigerian activist Ken Saro-Wiwa, Amnesty International is calling on Royal Dutch Shell to pay $1 billion in damages for the company's two 2008 oil spills in the Niger Delta, affecting the lives of 69,000 people. The two spills from a Shell pipeline occurred in the town of Bodo, a rural community that relies on fishing and farming for its survival. Shell failed to stop the first leak in August 2008 for 2 weeks. Amnesty estimates more oil leaked in this spill than from the Exxon Valdez disaster in 1989. Currently, the fight over monetary damages is tied up in a British court. Shell blames the oil spills on sabotage, denying that poor maintenance of the pipeline was responsible. Amnesty claims the oil spills directly harmed the health of villagers in Bodo by contaminating the community's drinking water supply. Air quality in the region has also deteriorated as the warm sun releases oil fumes. Militant groups in the region, like the Movement to Emancipate the Niger Delta, or MEND, are resuming their operations, which have included kidnappings and attacks on foreign oil company workers. The situation had been quiet since 2009, when the Nigerian government offered amnesty to top MEND commanders. But rebel leaders now complain of broken government promises and a deadly legacy of decades of oil pollution in the Niger Delta. On November 6, 2010, Russian blogger and journalist Oleg Kashin was badly beaten with a crowbar in front of his Moscow home. Kashin could have easily died, but was saved by emergency surgery paid for by his publisher, Alisher Usmanov, a wealthy metal magnate who is friends with outgoing Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Kashin, who writes about Russia's political youth groups for the country's largest daily newspaper, Kommersant, urged his large circle of journalist friends to put pressure on the president to launch a full-scale investigation. Although Medvedev promised the attackers would be brought to justice, no one has yet been charged in the case, and the investigation is falling apart. Although an establishment journalist, Kashin is no closer to achieving justice than the families of murdered colleagues like investigative reporter Anna Politkovskaya or Forbes editor Paul Klebnikov. For the first 10 months of the inquiry, Sergei Galkin led the investigation, the same official who had investigated other attacks on journalists, including the Politkovskaya case. Detectives looked into links between pro-Kremlin youth groups and the attack on Kashin and found that the blogger was under surveillance by the youth wing of Vladimir Putin's political party, United Russia. Galkin was pulled off the case in October and replaced by another detective after Medvedev announced he would step aside to allow Vladimir Putin to run for another term as Russia's president. Now, any chance of arresting the attackers, let alone finding out who ordered the attack on Kashin, is fading fast. After serving 20 years as sheriff of Arizona's Maricopa County, Joe Arpaio, a strong ally of the right-wing Tea Party movement, could be in political trouble. On election night, Arpaio stood next to defeated State Senate President Russell Pierce, an anti-immigrant ally who lost a recall election driven by moderate Republicans and Latino voters. It was the second big defeat for Arpaio in 2 years. Former county attorney Andrew Thomas, who devised the legal rationale for Arpaio's immigrant raids, lost the GOP primary for Arizona Attorney General in 2010. Arpaio now faces two federal Justice Department investigations involving charges that he abused his office and violated the civil rights of Latinos. In 2010, the Justice Department sued Arpaio for access to records in the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, which includes Phoenix and surrounding suburbs. At the time of the lawsuit in 2010, Arpaio stated, "They are not going to put handcuffs on this sheriff. I am not going to surrender." In recent months, Arpaio inserted himself into the 2012 GOP presidential primary race by deputizing his cold case posse to investigate President Obama's birth certificate and considering endorsements for Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, and Michelle Bachmann. Even though a strong challenger has not yet emerged, Sheriff Arpaio is expecting a tough re-election fight in 2012. Randy Peraz, who organized the successful recall campaign against Russell Pierce, has his sights set on Arpaio and his extremist brand of politics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Although the police carried out New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's order to evict Occupy Wall Street activists and remove their tents and infrastructure from Zuccotti Park with brutal efficiency on November 15th, the park remains a hub of the movement. A recent visit to Zuccotti Park found that a large number of activists remained there, participating in rallies, organizing protests, and conducting daily General Assembly meetings. New York City's Occupy movement showed its strength just 2 days after Bloomberg's raid and on the second-month anniversary of their founding, when organizers employed nonviolent civil disobedience in an attempt to close down the New York City Stock Exchange and massed tens of thousands of protesters on a march across the Brooklyn Bridge in what they called a Festival of Lights. Elsewhere around the country, local governments and police are continuing their attempt to suppress the Occupy movement by dismantling encampments and physically assaulting activists. A recent incident where video images captured police officers on the campus of the University of California at Davis attacking activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience with pepper spray at point-blank range has generated public outrage at police and renewed support for the movement. Your reporter traveled to New York's Zuccotti Park on November 19th and sat down with two members of the Occupy Wall Street media team, Mark Bray and Senya Berrigan, who talk about how the dismantling of the park has affected their organizing and some of the major issues confronting their fast-growing national movement.
So about 1 o'clock in the morning on that day, Mayor Bloomberg ordered the NYPD to clear out Zuccotti Park or Liberty Square. So they blocked off about 2 or 3 blocks kind of radius, so no one could get in. There was a complete media blackout. No reporters were allowed in. In fact, several were arrested. A councilman was arrested as well and bruised on the head trying to get in to observe. And so in the process, a lot of our fellow occupiers were violently torn from that park. A lot of them were brutalized by the NYPD, and about thousands, I don't know how many, I think 5,000 books, that more or less the number, thousands of books were destroyed, computers were destroyed in the process, and a lot of our fellow comrades were pepper sprayed. And so it was, you know, I think it was just a complete act of cowardice in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning. Young people who have families, who have mothers, who have fathers, who have sisters, who have brothers. These aren't just animals. These are real human beings who are out there for real issues.
I've heard some people say that the park was certainly critical to getting this movement off the ground, you know, in New York and nationally and even internationally. But having been there for almost 8 weeks, people are still there during the day, but you can't camp out and you don't have the infrastructure that you had before. How much of a difference is that going to make in terms of organizing outreach and having the public visibility, which made this so powerful?
Well, you're absolutely right that the park was instrumental in getting the movement off the ground to begin with. Obviously, we took the tactic of having a geographic location as a center of our movement and having an encampment from the examples of the Arab Spring and the Indignados in Spain and various movements in France and Greece and so forth. And so, you know, initially I was kind of skeptical of that. I thought it was maybe a shallow imitation of more serious struggles in other parts of the world. But it really has captured the imagination of a wide percentage of the American people. And, you know, the issues that we're struggling for, economic justice, democracy, education and healthcare, these are not new issues. Unfortunately, they've been issues for a long time. But the demonstration against it, the protest against it, has been given a renewed vitality through this tactic. And so, you know, it's interesting because when we had the park, a lot of the press said, Well, why do you need a park to have a social movement? Can't you just do it without a park? And now that we've lost the park, the very same press is saying, well, how could you have a social movement without the park? You need the park. So in a strong sense, there's a tendency to try and be negative towards what we're doing, no matter what we do, and we have to put that aside. So, you know, certainly it was a setback. Certainly we would have liked to stay in the park, and it would be insincere to say that we weren't hurt by what happened. But nevertheless, it's important to clarify, and a lot of outsiders don't realize that much of the actual organizing, the organizing meetings, were happening away from the park, if only because there wasn't a lot of space with all the tents and everything. And we have donated office space, storage space, a donated kitchen. We have a large infrastructure and apparatus and network of communication that's outside of the park that wasn't touched by what happened. And so the challenge now, in my mind, is to take the momentum we've gained, because certainly we got much bigger, much faster than anyone could have expected. In a certain sense, we had a movement before an organization. And to use the success and the popularity we've gotten to try and expand throughout the boroughs and make the Occupy movement much bigger than Lower Manhattan.
I had a question for you about national coordination. And that is obviously with the news reports and the leaked information that the police and the government, the federal government, were in ways involved in suppressing this movement. How far along is the coordination between the various groups for some, you know, national actions, as well as some things in the future maybe I'm not even thinking of, and maybe you aren't either? But
well, we have regular conference calls on different themes among different members of certain working groups. And I think the degree of repression we faced has accelerated our communication, because it's forced us to. And so some of the earliest examples of that really bearing fruit were solidarity marches we had with Oakland, the fact that we donated, $20,000 and 100 tents to their occupation. And I know that a lot of people from the different occupations have come to New York, and when I used to sit at our press table, I would meet people from North Carolina, from Chicago, from Vermont, from Montreal, Toronto, London, you know, that would come. And, you know, there was a certain sense that we were sort of a hub for this, because we kind of got it going in the United States. And so we've been enhancing our communication and our coordination. And I think you'll see, as time goes along, more days of national action even than we've had in the past. There's already talk potentially of having a national gathering in D.C. in the spring among all the occupiers coming down there. And so it's important, and the technology's made it easier. And I think the nice thing about it is that although people have sort of looked to New York as the start of it, we're trying more and more to shed that title and encourage initiative elsewhere and try to follow along.
That was Occupy Wall Street media team members Mark Bray and Senya Berrigan. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org. The announcement by the Democratic and Republican chairs of the Congressional Supercommittee that they had failed to reach agreement on cutting the nation's deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next decade was greeted by some with disappointment, but many others were relieved that proposed severe austerity measures were off the table, at least for now. President Obama and congressional legislators from both parties have consistently discussed their desire to reach a so-called grand bargain that would reach deficit reduction targets largely by invoking draconian cuts in benefits for recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in exchange for some modest tax increases. The deal that brought about the 12-member joint House-Senate supercommittee endowed with extraordinary powers came out of Tea Party Republican obstruction of an extension of the national debt ceiling that many saw as a tactic to extort concessions on budget cuts. This maneuver brought the federal government uncomfortably close to default and resulted in the downgrading of the U.S. bond rating in August. Now, with the failure of the supercommittee, an automatic $1.2 trillion in cuts will be made from both the defense and domestic budgets unless Congress arrives at a new agreement. But while Tea Party politicians push for austerity measures, accompanied by their slogan that government is the enemy, may have gone virtually unchallenged over the last 2 years, the exponential growth of the new Occupy Wall Street movement and the popularity of their message decrying economic inequality and political corruption may have changed the political climate in Washington. The Democrats' uncharacteristic refusal to cave into GOP demands may be attributed to the power of the Occupy movement. Your reporter spoke with Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. He assesses the power of the Occupy Wall Street movement and how the European economic crisis could be a preview of the battles ahead here in the U.S.
You know, it wasn't that many months ago that all we heard about was the Tea Party. Now we barely read about the Tea Party. We read about Occupy this, Occupy that, and the next thing. It is extraordinary. They have raised these basic questions about our economic system, the unfairness of it, the 99 versus 1%. But they've had the courage we haven't seen in 50 years in the United States. They are questioning our economic system, capitalism by name, and they're saying it's long overdue. For 50 years, we've debated our educational system, our transportation system. Last year, we had a national debate about our health system. But one thing is off limits. One thing is a taboo, our economic system. So we don't debate and criticize and see if we can do better the way we ought to in a healthy society. We've had a taboo because of the Cold War and because of the kind of hysterical anti-communism that has suffused our country all these years. And this is a movement that is questioning all that and doing it in a straightforward and honest way, resisting the efforts of the authorities to squelch it, of the police to intimidate it. It is amazing what has been done in 2 months, and every sign points to this being a movement in the early stages of changing the United States. And I think it's an incredible time to be alive and to be able to watch, and even better, to participate.
Now, I wonder, from the perspective of someone who's seen movements come and go and protests come and go, do you see what's developed here with the Occupy Wall Street movement as a transformative movement versus a short-lived series of protests?
In the years since I've been born and lived my life in the United States, I've seen protest movements, but most of them have been focused on single issues: the concern for civil liberties, the concern for civil rights, for the right to have your own sexual orientation, for the right of immigrants to have a decent chance at the American dream, and all of that. And I noticed each time that the movements were specific, they were around a single issue, and when they tried to broaden out, they were told, even by their friends, it's too dangerous. Don't raise these basic questions about American society. It'll only divide you. It'll get you in trouble. And that's what contributed to keeping the economic system from being subjected to the normal criticism that we use to subject them to other systems to make them better. It was part of a way that even the critics of our society who were trying to make it better shied away from facing the economic realities of our system. And this is the first movement I've ever seen that doesn't shy away, that puts it front and center, that says, look, beyond the particular issues we disagree about, 99% of us know in our hearts that this is a system that is making the rich richer and everybody else is having a harder time, and that's basic, and that unites us, and if we focus on that, we can make the biggest, most far-reaching changes that this country needs, and we can do it because we'll all be together. That kind of unity, that kind of overcoming of the fragmentation that has afflicted critical social movements in the past, that is an enormous, transformative new start in the United States.
Well, Professor Wolf, before you go, maybe you can talk about the battle going on right now in Europe over austerity policies that are being foisted on the people of Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and other nations, and the resistance we see developing in the streets. Where is that battle headed? And do you think that the result of the conflicts in Europe may usher in some new economic structures that will be fair and that will maybe displace the euro as the common currency, but in the end will spare the people of Europe from these draconian policies that are coming down on them from a hierarchy that they don't seem to be able to control?
You know, I think that we ought to pay close attention to Europe, because Europe is shaping up to be our future that we can look at before we arrive at it, and maybe we can navigate our future a little bit better by paying close attention to the pre-war of it in Europe now. Basically, you're seeing in Europe a fundamental civil conflict between the business community, the banks, and the politicians that they control, trying to maintain the power, trying to respond to this crisis, which gets deeper each year, by policies that protect their dominance in the society. And on the other hand, the mass of people who don't see their interests being represented, who see the crisis as an assault on their well-being, who see the government's handling of it a further assault on their well-being, and who have now dug in their heels and said, this crisis is your fault, the recovery you made served only you, you're not now going to make us pay for your failed economic system and your failed political system on top of it. But the punchline here is the exact same battle over the exact same issues is what's going on in the United States. The details are different. The basic story is the same.
That was Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now a visiting professor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. His latest book is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan. Find links to Professor Wolff's articles on our website at btlonline.org. Mazen Kumsia, a professor of genetics who worked at several American universities before returning to his native Palestine, is the author of four books, including his latest titled Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. As an activist as well as an academic, Kumsia had hoped to be a passenger on board the most recent ship convoy attempting to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza in early November, but was bumped at the last minute when the Turkish government forced organizers to reduce the number of passengers by two-thirds. Professor Kumsia returned to his home in Beit Sahur near Bethlehem in time to present a talk on the Palestinian struggle to a group of international solidarity activists. Less than a week later, Kumsia was one of six Palestinians arrested when they boarded an Israelis-only bus that brings Israeli settlers from the West Bank into Jerusalem. They called their action the Freedom Rides in reference to dangerous journeys into the American South on interstate buses that black and white civil rights activists undertook in the early 1960s. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded Kumsia's talk at Beit Sahur's Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. An excerpt of the talk, which covers the history of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance struggle, is presented here.
People are very familiar with this uprising, 1987 to 1991, which was called the Uprising of the Stones because Palestinian children were using stones, as you can see, there to throw at Israeli soldiers who responded by shooting live ammunition, or when they didn't do that, as Rabin instructed them to, was to break the bones of Palestinians who participate. So they would literally catch people and they would break their long bones intentionally. These are all forms of resistance that Palestinians engage in. For us to exist on this land is to resist, because basically picking olives like we did last month under the circumstances of occupation, colonization, especially in areas where the soldiers and the settlers do not want us to pick our own olive trees, is a form of resistance. When this shepherd woman took her sheep to the field like this, when the soldiers see her up there, and the settlers don't want her to do this, that's a form of nonviolent resistance. The settlers even went to the extreme of putting poison pellets for the sheep so that the sheep will eat those and die, and she will have no reason then to continue to go to this field. And yet she continued to go to this field. She continued to pick up these pellets and clean the field. all these young people having their prayer maybe for the last time at this land which will be confiscated to build colonial settlements. Arguing with soldier when you can see the bulldozer uprooting olive trees that his great-grandparents had planted. These are all forms of nonviolent resistance. These are all inspiring forms, inspiring acts of what we call in Arabic sumud. Sumud means like persistence, resilience, combination of things. On Palm Sunday, the tradition for us Palestinian Christians, accompanied by Palestinian Muslims, is to go to Jerusalem, to walk to Jerusalem, because Jesus, who is venerated also by Muslims, walked or rode actually on a donkey to enter Jerusalem. So we take palm leaves and things like that and we walk to Jerusalem. We take donkeys and go to Jerusalem. All the occupiers of Jerusalem before Israel allowed this tradition to continue. Only Israel prevented this tradition in the last few years. I'm talking about the British before Israel, the Jordanians, the Ottomans, the Crusaders even, everybody. You know, everybody who was here occupied this land, allowed this tradition to continue. Only Israel prevented this tradition from happening. So we said to ourselves, no, we were not going to accept this. So we walked to Jerusalem. We took about, you know, I don't remember, 100, 150 people, and we walked. And of course, we pushed the first gate, through the first gate, through the second gate, and we kept going. We reached about 300 meters into the so-called forbidden zone for us, Palestinian Christians and Muslims from Bethlehem. And until they gathered, of course, enough forces to start to arrest us. And actually, the first creatures they arrested was this gentleman, this donkey, and this mule. I kid you not, they arrested the donkey and the mule, and they charged them with illegally entering Jerusalem without a permit. Okay? To enter a donkey into Jerusalem, you need a permit, of course. You know, I started by saying I'm very optimistic. This BDS movement, just as an example, in the last 6 years, from the initial call by Palestinian civil society for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which happened in 2005, in those 6 years, we accomplished more than what South Africa did between the initial call by civil society in South Africa, which was 1955, to the 1980s, over 30 years. So we did in 6 years what South Africa was able to accomplish in 30 years.
That was Palestinian academic, author, and activist Mazen Kumsia, presenting a talk on the history of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance struggle. Visit our website at btlonline.org to learn more about Kumsia's work. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.